Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Friday, August 12th, 2022. My name is Rachel Thorson Mithelman, and I'll be your reader today. Looking at the front page, let's start with the Field of Dreams story. The headline is, "This Place is Magic." The article is accompanied by two photographs. One is of the Chicago Cubs starting pitcher Marcus Stroman posing in front of the Field of Dreams cornfield, and the other of Chicago Cubs right fielder Seiya Suzuki walking out of that cornfield before the game against the Cincinnati Reds last night. Players say big league games should continue at the Field of Dreams. This is by Jim Nelson from Dyersville. Wednesday afternoon, former Major League Baseball star Frank Thomas, now part owner of the Field of Dreams movie site, announced there would be no third installment of the Field of Dreams game next year. Thomas said construction of a youth sports complex around the site will prevent MLB from hosting the event. But Thursday, representatives of the Chicago Cubs and Cincinnati Reds said they hope the game will return to Iowa in future years. "It is clear it resonates," Reds star first baseman Joey Votto said. Jed Hoyer, Cubs president of baseball operations, talked with media prior to the game and said games like the one Thursday are important for Major League Baseball in the long term. "It is so important," Hoyer said. "The game isn't guaranteed. We have to keep growing the game, keep having games like this, continue to grow the game with young people, grow the game outside our diehard fans." That same sentiment was shared by the participants. "It brings people together that love the game," Reds manager David Bell said. "It is a great example of what the game is all about." Cubs star Ian Happ said from the moment he and his teammates arrived at the Dubuque airport and bused to the site, a roughly 40-minute commute, it was obvious what the game means to Iowa. "You see how important it is," Happ said. "I just think it is what baseball means to people, the family connection. Everybody has a story with how they fell in love with the game, what field they fell in love with, and you can feel that in this place. It is real. You feel that here." Chicago catcher Wilson Contreras echoed those comments. "I think this place is magic," Contreras said. "The energy is real." Cubs manager David Ross said he felt the energy. "The feeling when I got here, I got the urge to run when I got on the field, so I ran to our team picture. The moment you step out there, you feel like a kid," Ross said. The Cubs and Reds were welcomed with open arms by Iowans and the residents of Dyersville. As the teams arrived, hundreds of fans lined the roads of the city itself and porches on the road that leads to the park. The major leaguers, used to accolades and cheering crowds, nevertheless appreciated the reception. "I woke up feeling a little different," Bell said. "The excitement around it. I sensed that from our players and staff. It started to hit me as we drove on what is so special about this day, all the people who love this game. All the people who will be here will watch on TV. It's a group that loves the game. Really, that is what I've been thinking about all day." "The welcome we got here was pretty humbling," added Votto. "I don't think that is one way both sides feel how special this is." The coaches and players were asked if the game should come to Iowa after the announced one-year hiatus, and the Reds infielder Kyle Farmer summed it up best. "I think it should," Farmer said. "What they have done, created here, is incredible. You walk out here, the guys in the locker room are still talking about how cool it is. I think every baseball player should experience this, and you can tell how much it means to the people of Iowa. It is pretty cool." Next on the front page, Reynolds asks court to lift block on abortion law. Iowa would join 13 states that ban abortions after 6 weeks. This is by Aaron Murphy. Abortion would be illegal in Iowa after 6 weeks of pregnancy, often before the woman knows she is pregnant, if Governor Kim Reynolds' request to the Iowa courts is granted. Reynolds filed a motion Thursday asking a state court to lift an injunction on legislation passed in 2018 that would have banned abortion in Iowa at 6 weeks. That bill, passed by the Republican-led Iowa legislature and signed into law by Reynolds, was halted at the time by a district judge who cited a previous Iowa Supreme Court ruling that negated a 24-hour waiting period for an abortion. But since the U.S. Supreme Court and Iowa Supreme Court earlier this year issued rulings that effectively repealed a pregnant person's right to abortion access, Reynolds is asking the state courts to now lift the injunction on the 6-week ban. The historic U.S. Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe has given us a new hope and pathway forward to challenge the Iowa court's previous decision, Reynolds said in a statement. Life and death are determined by a person's heartbeat, and I believe that includes our unborn children. As long as I'm governor, I will stand up for the sanctity of life and fight to protect the precious and innocent unborn lives. Currently, abortion is legal in Iowa through 20 weeks of pregnancy. The 2018 legislation is known as the Fetal Heartbeat Bill, so named by its supporters because they say it bans abortions after a fetus heartbeat can be detected. However, medical experts say the heart is not developed at 6 weeks, and ultrasound machines at that point in a pregnancy are not actually detecting a heartbeat. According to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, what is actually heard at 6 weeks is the ultrasound machine translating electronic impulses that signify cardiac activity. It is clinically inaccurate to use the word heartbeat to describe the sound that can be heard on ultrasound in very early pregnancy. In fact, there are no chambers of the heart developed at the early stage in pregnancy that this word is used to describe, so there is no recognizable heartbeat, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says. If the court grants Reynolds' request and the 2018 law is enacted, Iowa would join 13 other states that ban abortion at 0 or 6 weeks of pregnancy, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a national nonprofit organization that monitors states' abortion laws and advocates for access to reproductive health care. The Iowa law at issue includes an exemption for medical emergencies, and the ban would not apply to pregnancies that are the result of rape or incest, provided those are reported to law enforcement or a healthcare agency within specified timeframes. The law states that a woman should not be criminally charged for having an abortion, but it does not grant the same protection for a physician who performs an abortion, nor any individual who assists the pregnant person who has an abortion. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, a Democrat, has declined to represent the state in the case, citing his opposition to the legislation. Reynolds, a Republican, and the state are being represented instead by Iowa conservative attorney Alan Ostergren and Alliance Defending Freedom, a national conservative legal organization that, according to its website, works to protect religious freedom, free speech, the sanctity of life, parental rights, and God's design for marriage and family. Neither Ostergren nor the Alliance Defending Freedom are being paid by the state for their work on the case. Iowa Democrats criticized Reynolds' approach. Our main differences on reproductive health are that I will be a governor who supports the will of the people. A majority of Iowans are pro-choice, and I stand with them, Deirdre DeGeer, the Democratic candidate running against Reynolds in this fall's election, said in a statement to the Gazette. When asked to what extent abortion should be legal in Iowa, DeGeer said Republicans are focused on a numbers game. "I'm not willing to engage in that," she said. "It's simple. Laws should protect, not regulate, women's rights." During a virtual news conference Thursday, state lawmaker Jennifer Confirst, the leader of the minority party Democrats in the Iowa House, noted public polling consistently shows a majority of Iowans and Americans believe abortions should be legal in some or most cases, and that Kansas voters recently voted down a proposed amendment that would have said their state's constitution does not protect an individual's right to abortions. Iowa Republican state lawmakers have started the process of proposing a state constitutional amendment similar to the one that was voted down in Kansas. If approved by lawmakers again in 2023 or 2024, that proposal would be decided by Iowa voters as early as the 2024 elections. "We know that Iowa Republicans want the most extreme abortion legislation they can get in the state. So rather than waiting until the legislature comes back in January and having an honest conversation about what abortion law looks like in Iowa and what reproductive freedom looks like in this state, Republicans are running to the courts and trying to have them circumvent the will of the people and address it that way. It's another example of politics over people," Confirst said. "This is way extreme. We've seen voters across the country reject this, and because the governor knows voters would reject this here in Iowa, she's playing politics." And the last story on the front page is Chamber Celebrates New Mural, and it is accompanied by a photograph of the new mural called Building Community. This is by Mary Loden. A ribbon cutting ceremony was held Thursday at Community Health Center in Mason City to celebrate the Building Community mural that was completed by more than 100 volunteers during July. The Mason City Chamber of Commerce's goal was to have the mural completed before RAGBRAI visited Mason City. More than 100 volunteers from local businesses, daycares, organizations, and citizens assisted in painting the mural, each leaving a signature thumbprint on the wall. According to a press release, Building Community is an initiative of the Mason City Chamber of Commerce to highlight the inclusive spirit of North Iowans. According to the 2020 U.S. Census, the diversity of Mason City's population stands at 93.17% white, but diversity, equity, and inclusion, commonly referred to as DEI, impact more than race and ethnicity. The Chamber's DEI program is positioned as a workforce attraction and retention strategy, and Anderson said they would like to get community employers on board. The community mural and the companion billboard campaign were intended to launch this program. The Community Health Center, located at the North Gateway to downtown Mason City, provided the perfect backdrop, and CHC was excited about the mural request. Let's take a moment to look at today in history. Today is Friday, August 12th, the 224th day of 2022. There are 141 days left in the year. Today's highlight: on August 12th, 1953, the Soviet Union conducted a secret test of its first hydrogen bomb. On this date in 1867, President Andrew Johnson sparked a move to impeach him as he defied Congress by suspending Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton, with whom he had clashed over Reconstruction policies. Johnson was acquitted by the Senate. On this date in 1898, fighting in the Spanish-American War came to an end. On this date in 1909, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, home to the first Indianapolis 500, first opened. On this date in 1944, during World War II, Joseph P. Kennedy Jr., eldest son of Joseph and Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy, was killed with his co-pilot when their explosives-laden Navy plane blew up over England. On this date in 1960, the first balloon communications satellite, the Echo 1, was launched by the United States from Cape Canaveral. On this date in 1964, author Ian Fleming, age 56, the creator of James Bond, died in Canterbury, England. On this date in 1978, Pope Paul VI, who had died August 6th at the age of 80, was buried in St. Peter's Basilica. On this date in 1981, IBM introduced its first personal computer, the Model 5150, at a press conference in New York. And on this date in 1985, the world's worst single aircraft disaster occurred as a crippled Japan Airlines Boeing 747 on a domestic flight crashed into a mountain, killing 520 people. Four people survived. Turning now to page two of the paper, an Associated Press article from New York titled, Trump's Bond with GOP Deepens After Recent Events. Donald Trump's pick for governor in the swing state of Wisconsin easily defeated a favorite of the Republican establishment. In Connecticut, the state that launched the Bush family and its brand of compassionate conservatism, a fiery Senate contender who promoted Trump's election lies upset the state GOP's endorsed candidate. Meanwhile, in Washington, Republicans ranging from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to conspiracy theorist Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene defended Trump against an unprecedented FBI search. And that was just this week. The rapid developments crystallized the former president's singular status atop a party he has spent the past 7 years breaking down and rebuilding in his image. Facing mounting legal vulnerabilities and considering another presidential run, he needs support from the party to maintain his political career. But whether they like it or not, many in the party also need Trump, whose endorsement has proven crucial for those seeking to advance to the November ballot. For a pretty good stretch, it felt like the Trump movement was losing more ground than it was gaining, said Georgia Republican Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, who is urging his party to move past Trump. But now he said Trump is benefiting from an incredibly swift tailwind. The Republican response to the FBI's search of Trump's Florida estate this week was an especially stark example of how the party is keeping Trump nearby. Some of the Republicans considering challenges to Trump in a 2024 presidential primary, such as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, were among those defending him. Even long-established Trump critics like Maryland Governor Larry Hogan questioned the search, pressing for details about its circumstances. But even before the FBI showed up at Mar-a-Lago, Trump was gaining momentum in his post-presidential effort to shape the GOP. In all, nearly 180 Trump-endorsed candidates up and down the ballot have won their primaries since May, while fewer than 20 have lost. Only two of the 10 House Republicans who supported Trump's impeachment after the January 6th insurrection are expected back in Congress next year. Representative Jamie Herrera Butler, Republican of Washington, who conceded defeat after her Tuesday primary, was the latest to fall. Leading Trump antagonist, Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, is at risk of joining her next week. The Trump victories include a clean sweep of statewide primary elections in Arizona last week, including an election denier in the race for the state's chief elections official. Trump's allies also prevailed Tuesday across Wisconsin and Connecticut, a state long known for its moderate Republican leanings. In Wisconsin's Republican primary for governor, wealthy Trump-backed businessman Tim Michels defeated former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clefish, an establishment favorite. And in Connecticut, Leora Levy, who promoted Trump's lie that the 2020 election was stolen, surged to an unexpected victory over a more moderate rival after earning Trump's official endorsement. On Monday, just hours after the FBI search, Trump hosted a Teletown Hall rally on her behalf. Levy thanked Trump in her acceptance speech while railing against the FBI's search. "All of us can tell him how upset and offended and disgusted we were at what happened to him," she said. "That is un-American. That is what they do in Cuba, in China, in dictatorships, and that will stop." Despite his recent dominance, Trump and the Republicans close to him face political and legal threats that could undermine their momentum as the GOP fights for control of Congress and state houses across the nation this fall. While Trump's picks have notched notable victories in primaries this summer, they may struggle in the fall. That's especially true in several governors' races in Democratic-leaning states such as Connecticut and Maryland, where GOP candidates must track to the center to win a general election. Meanwhile, several Republicans with White House ambitions are moving forward with a busy travel schedule that will take them to politically important states where they can back candidates on the ballot this year and build relationships heading into 2024. On the legal front, the FBI search was part of an investigation into whether the former president took classified records from the White House to his Florida residence. While Republicans have rallied behind Trump, very few facts about the case have been released publicly. Trump's attorneys have so far declined to release details from the search warrant. Prosecutors in Washington and Georgia are also investigating Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election he falsely claimed was stolen. The January 6th Congressional Commission has exposed damning details about Trump's behavior from Republican witnesses in recent hearings, which have prompted new concerns, at least privately, among the GOP establishment and donor class. And this on page 2 of the front section of the paper: "We're back, baby. New bill boosts U.S. climate credibility." This is from the Associated Press in Washington. After a moment when hopes dimmed that the United States could become an international leader on climate change, legislation that Congress is poised to approve could rejuvenate the country's reputation and bolster its efforts to push other nations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions more quickly. The head-snapping turn of events, which has generated a joyful case of whiplash among Democrats and environmentalists, is a reminder of how domestic politics is intertwined with worldwide diplomacy. Advocates feared that last month's breakdown in negotiations in Congress had undermined efforts to limit the catastrophic effects of global warming. Now they're energized by the opportunity to tout an unprecedented U.S. success. "This says we are back, baby," said Jennifer Turner, who works on international climate issues as a director of the Woodrow Wilson Center's China Environment Forum in Washington. The legislation, which also has provisions on taxes and prescription drugs, includes about $375 billion over the next decade for clean energy development and financial incentives for buying electric cars, installing solar panels, and weaning the power grid off fossil fuels. Although the proposals were downsized during difficult negotiations, it's the single biggest investment in climate change in U.S. history, and a significant shift from years of inaction that limited Washington's clout overseas. The Senate passed the legislation on Sunday, and the House is expected to approve it on Friday. Then it goes to President Joe Biden for his signature. Poor nations remain concerned that rich countries like the United States have not fulfilled financial commitments to help them cope with global warming and transition to clean energy, something the legislation does not address. But Biden can still point to it as evidence that the U.S. political system can address the world's most pressing problems. Our ability to have credibility on the global stage depends on our ability to deliver at home, said Ali Zaidi, the White House Deputy National Climate Advisor. We are the pace car that helps other people go faster and faster. After President Donald Trump withdrew from the Paris Climate Accord, Biden entered office pledging to rejoin the fight against global warming. He set an ambitious new target for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, at least 50% below 2005 levels by 2030, and began proposing policies to put the country on track. The legislation that Biden is expected to sign is estimated to reduce emissions between 31 and 44%, according to an analysis by the Rhodium Group, an independent research firm. Further regulatory steps by the administration could close the rest of the gap. It's good that finally the U.S. is trying to catch up after years of dragging its feet on climate change, and this investment will go a long way to undoing some of the harm caused by the administration of President Trump, said Mohammed Adao, director of Power Shift Africa, a think tank based in Nairobi, Kenya. The movement on the bill comes just 3 months before the next UN conference on climate change, which is known as COP27, and will take place in Egypt. Let's hope this legislation is the start of more international cooperation in the lead-up to the COP27 summit, where the most vulnerable get the support they need, Adao said. Although the U.S. will still face entrenched skepticism, the progress in Washington may also give John Kerry, the White House's special envoy on climate, more momentum going into the conference in November. It puts wind in his sail. It gives him a real credibility boost, Turner said. This will change the whole dynamic. And to finish this half hour, we'll turn to some short news notices. First from Detroit, mistrial declared in Flint water case. A judge declared a mistrial Thursday after jurors said they couldn't reach a verdict in a dispute over whether two engineering firms should bear some responsibility for Flint's lead-contaminated water. Veolia North America and Lockwood Andrews and Newman, known as LAN, were accused of not doing enough to get Flint to treat the highly corrosive water or to urge a return to a regional water supplier. A mistrial was declared in federal court in Ann Arbor, Michigan, court spokesman David Aschenfelter said. Next, Africa in talks for monkeypox vaccine, this from Nairobi. Africa's public health agency says the continent of 1.3 billion people still does not have a single dose of the monkeypox vaccine, but very advanced discussions are underway with at least two partners. The acting director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Ahmed Ugwell, told journalists on Thursday that he could not give details, but he said the partners are largely multilateral institutions and non-African governments. There are no discussions with the private sector because all available doses have already been bought by countries, he said. but a clinical trial is underway in Congo for a vaccine, Jynneos, that's under emergency use authorization, Ogwal said. The two-dose vaccine is considered the main medical weapon against the disease, but its availability is limited. The Africa CDC did not immediately respond to a question about the details of the trial. More monkeypox deaths have been reported on the African continent this year than anywhere in the world. Since May, nearly 90 countries have reported more than 31,000 cases. And these very brief notices. Miners trapped. Rescue divers' first attempts to reach 10 miners trapped inside a flooded coal mine since last week were stopped by debris-filled shafts and poor visibility, Mexican authorities said Thursday. In South Carolina, a beachgoer was killed Wednesday after a loose beach umbrella impaled her in the chest, authorities said. The umbrella was blown from its anchoring by the wind at around 12:40 p.m. and hit Tammy Persault while she was at a Garden City beach, said Horry County Chief Deputy Coroner Tamara Willard. This from Europe. Firefighters from across Europe struggled Thursday to contain a huge wildfire in France that has swept through a large swath of pine forest, while Germans and Poles faced a mass fish die-off in a river flowing between their countries. Europe is suffering under a severe heat wave and drought that has produced tragic consequences for farmers and ecosystems already under threat from climate change and pollution. And finally this, the Palestinian death toll from last weekend's fighting between Israel and Gaza militants rose to 48 Thursday, after an 11-year-old girl and a man died from wounds they suffered during the worst cross-border violence in over a year. You are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. My name is Rachel Thorson Mithelman. If you have comments on this or any other IRIS program, feel free to give us a call at 515-243-6833. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. In today's paper, there is one obituary for Dennis L. Nelson. This is from Belmond. Dennis L. Nelson, age 63, of Belmond, Iowa, died August 6, 2022, at Belmond. Public funeral services are Monday, August 15th, at 10:30 a.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church, 304 3rd Avenue Northeast in Belmond. Burial will be in the Belmond Cemetery. Public visitation Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. at the church, and also from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Monday prior to the funeral at the church. Andrew's Funeral Home in Belmond is handling arrangements, and more information can be found on their website, andrewsfuneralhomeandfloral.com. Then there are two brief death notices. Patricia J. Hialy of Mason City died Wednesday, August 10, 2022, at the Mercy One North Iowa Hospice. Arrangements are with the Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel. And Darlene C. Pope of Britt died Saturday, August 6, 2022, at the Hancock County Memorial Hospital in Britt. Arrangements are pending at the Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel. Before we turn to sports, there's a very interesting article on the page that's titled Kid News, and it's titled Creative Crash Course. Students attend a workshop to build their writing skills. This is from the Hartford, Connecticut newspaper, The Current. The successes of Rockville High School's creative writing classes have become well known when it comes to receiving awards and recognition, partially due to the Connecticut class's dedication even during summer vacation. Some of these students, along with teacher Victoria Nordland, spend time in the summer honing their craft by creating, writing, and producing an online literary magazine titled Journey 75 at the Nook Farm Writers Collaborative, a program at the Mark Twain House and Museum in Hartford, Connecticut. For 6 weeks, the students, under the direction of Nordland and program coordinator Aaron Bartram, produce a variety of pieces inspired by Mark Twain's writing career, including journalism, essays, poetry, and short stories, culminating in a personal portfolio. With the support of workshops led by a variety of writers and editors from around the country, the students also work collaboratively to design and produce an online literary journal featuring their works. We bring in people that have jobs within this field so they can see what it's like to be a writer, a marketer, or an editor, Nordland said. They learn about these careers. They're also putting together their own website, literary journal, and they get skills as part of an editorial team or a marketing team. Everybody has a job. On July 18th, the students had a workshop with Hartford Current community reporter Steve Smith, who gave them some basic thoughts on how to interview people in order to dig deeper into their topic, how to stay conversational while being professional, and the five W's, who, what, where, when, and why, with emphasis on the why. The next day, the students put these lessons to use as they interviewed Nick Paley, who wrote and directed the movie Marcel the Shell via Zoom, asking him about his process of writing the movie, creating the character, and the challenges of filming stop-motion animation. It's trying to bring something that you really care about and something very personal, and it's hard to put into words, and you're afraid people aren't going to understand it, he said. But now on the other side of it, I can tell you that sharing the movie with everyone and having people hear it, really understand what we were trying to say with it, and they're totally getting it, and you feel more known and heard. That makes the big dip in the middle of it worth it. Paley told the students that one key to successful writing is being fearless and doing what you want to do without worrying about whether other people like it. The best thing you can do to learn how to write is to learn how to pay attention to your own life, he said. See what you are interested in. There's nobody in the world who can tell you you're a writer. You just have to decide that and act like everything you are interested in and care about really matters. It's the most important thing to your work. It's about giving yourself authority to say, what I experience and think is interesting. The students said they appreciated Paley's thoughts. What's always interesting to me in an interview like this is how people react to being asked questions, student Tova Oslovich said. He was really friendly, and he gave insight into the fact that people who make really cool things are really just humans with interesting brains. What I found really interesting is I like to view what's happening behind the scenes and how people invent the magic before the actors and animation come in, said Kim Yankson, also a Rockville student. The students added that they are learning a great deal in the program while thoroughly enjoying it. I've always really liked writing, said Rebecca Tsarkov, a high school sophomore. I enjoy interviewing people and writing for the school newspaper. I want to be an investigative journalist, which I haven't tried yet, but out of all the different topics in journalism, that sounds the most interesting. That exposure the program provides to different facets of writing, Tsarkov said, is valuable. I love trying all these different kinds of writing, like poetry, which I haven't done before, she said, adding that as part of the magazine's marketing team, she's working on publicity. We just kind of started that, but we're going on social media and figuring out how to get the word out there about the magazine, she said. Turning to sports, we'll start with some local prep football preview of Newman Catholic. This is by Zach Martin of the Globe Gazette. It's titled Climbing the Ladder. Newman aims to be a threat for title with bevy of talent back. It's not November, but Rich McArdle is thankful for one thing. We're glad four teams get to out of this district to the playoffs, Newman Catholic's head football coach said. Okay, I'm going to read that again, and I think there's a word missing. It's not November, but Rich McArdle is thankful for one thing. We are glad four teams get out of this district to the playoffs, Newman Catholic's head football coach said. Glance at Class A District 2, and it proved to be one of the tougher districts in the classification. It had the state champion in West Hancock, plus another top five team in North Butler. McArdle's Knights finished with six wins. St. Ansgar went on a late run to make the playoffs at 3-6 with three district wins. Lake Mills and North Union weren't far behind. We're probably right on that line, where we're definitely a threat, Newman senior Logan Lurson said. As long as we keep doing our thing, we're right on that line to be a favorite. The local heavy clump will remain strong. So too will the Knights. With their quarterback and top four tacklers, plus one of the best ball hawks in the state returning, Newman is attempting to win its first district title since 2018. For the last 2 years, it has been a threat to challenge for the top of the standings. Now it is trying to become a favorite. It's a matter of everything clicking at the right time, senior Max Burt stated. Until that happens, I still think we're a dangerous team, but once the puzzle pieces come together, we'll be one of those tougher teams. There are just over 30 guys on the roster for 2022, smaller than what McArdle wants. Still, he's got a lot of talent at his disposal, paced by Burt. The Iowa baseball commit is under center for the third time in his prep career and is coming off an all-district season with 1,300 passing yards and 14 touchdowns to just two interceptions. It is always nice those first couple years you're still getting used to things, Burt said. You just feel a lot more knowledgeable about the goals and what we can do. He's already one of the more poised quarterbacks in the district, but he was able to show off his mobility to the tune of 9 touchdowns. With the graduation of the Knights' top two rushers, he could get more carries. And he's ready for that. I definitely think it is possible, he said. McArdle admitted early in the year that Newman might favor the pass over the run. He's got options to replace James Jennings and Jack Mesneo in the backfield, but none have varsity experience. Gabe Lewerke has the most carries from a returning running back with 12 for 38 yards. Now it is time for the new kids to show up, McArdle said. I know kind of who is out there. We don't have any senior running backs. I've seen some rays of hope. Noah Hamilton and Toby Keston are in line to see an increase in targets and receiving yards. Both finished with triple-digit yards and 17 combined catches. Hamilton is embracing the opportunity. When we spread out, we should be more pass-heavy, he said. Defensively, the Knights bring back their top four tacklers in Tyler Wolf, Burt, Pete Miller, and Hamilton. Keston is anchoring the secondary after recording 4 interceptions. Specifically speaking of Keston, McArdle is intrigued about his development. He comes in, he looks bigger, more confident, McArdle said. As far as a nose for the ball, he has that. The Knights scored just 19 points against West Hancock and North Butler, the only two teams that finished ahead of them in the standings. Against the Eagles, it was in the slop. versus the Bearcats, they stomped Newman on its homecoming. "Those losses we won't forget," Larson said. "They give us a chip on our shoulder. We want to run it right back in their mouths at their places." There is a sense of being rejuvenated this fall. Hamilton has the sense that the Knights can make the transition from being a team talked about of winning a district to doing it. Things have to break their way, and the senior is aware of that. "Just adjusting where we are at as a team," Hamilton says. "We got a good chance." There isn't an easy game amongst the district. West Hancock remains a threat. St. Ansgar brings a core back, and McArdle made sure to mention North Union as a potential party crasher. Still, the Knights coach knows what his team is capable of. "We'll know a lot after week one," he said. A bit of NASCAR news. Getting interesting. Harvick win complicates NASCAR playoff spots in final weeks. This is from Brooklyn, Michigan, from the Associated Press. NASCAR just got more interesting down the stretch. Kevin Harvick won his first cup race in nearly 2 years at Michigan International Speedway over the weekend, a result that could mean a driver who has a win getting knocked out of the playoffs. "It creates a big bubble," Harvick said Sunday. "I think some of those guys that have won races that hadn't been doing very good, it creates a real scenario to where there could be at least 16 winners. There's a lot of things that can still happen." Just 3 races remain in the regular season, the next being Sunday at Richmond Raceway in Virginia, and time is running out to secure a spot in the 16-driver postseason. 15 different drivers have won races this year. If there are 2 new winners in the final weeks at Richmond, Watkins Glen, or Daytona, someone with 1 win will be eliminated from the playoff based on a tiebreaker on points. Martin Truex Jr. is number 4 in points, but he does not have a win and desperately needs one to earn a spot in the round of 16 at Darlington Raceway in South Carolina. Ryan Blaney is 2nd in points, but he too is without a victory. Should they both land a first-place finish at a race, someone like Austin Cindric or Chase Briscoe could be staying at home next month. "We're racing 19, Cindric, obviously for points, and try to win the race," Blaney said after making a late pass to finish 5th. No one could catch Harvick in his number 4 Ford following a restart with 35 laps to go at the Firekeepers Casino 400. Bubba Wallace had maybe the best chance to compete with Harvick, but he chose a path for the number 23 Toyota that he later lamented. "I wanted to win so bad, and this was the best opportunity," Wallace said, after finishing 2nd following his first career pole. Harvick, meanwhile, won his 59th career cup event and ended a 65-race drought that started after winning his 9th race during the 2020 playoffs at Bristol Motor Speedway. "I've been through longer winless streaks," he said with a shrug. That's a fact. Harvick's longest streak is 115 races from 2007 to 2010. The Stuart Haas racing driver went to Michigan sitting at number 17 in points and left in 9th place. It was his 6th win overall at the 2-mile oval. The 46-year-old insisted he didn't need the latest result to boost his confidence. "Maybe I'm overconfident," he said. "I expect to win until the door closes." Ford certainly needed assurances it could win with the next-gen car, considering Chevrolet has dominated the series with 13 victories, including 4 for points leader Chase Elliott. Harvick gave Ford its first cup win in 2 months and 5th of the season to pull into a 2nd-place tie with Toyota. "We just have to keep pushing and try to run with those top guys, and we have," Harvick crew chief Rodney Childers said. "If we can do that in the playoffs and be consistent and get through a round or 2, we can make some noise." And some Iowa State football news. Tyler Moore staying composed for Cyclones. This is by Rob Gray from Ames. He swung a bat and hurled a baseball at an elite level. His diamond-based skills took him to one of the sport's biggest stages, the Little League World Series at Williamsport, New York. Those were heady times for then preteen Tyler Moore of Johnston, who said baseball is his first love, but now is fully focused on snaring passes instead of fly balls as a tight end for Iowa State. I don't feel like anything compares to being on the sidelines, especially in Jack Trice Stadium, because that place is always rocking. But I feel like being in front of those cameras at such a young age, it was definitely good to experience that, said Moore, a redshirt freshman. So then when I got here, I guess it was not that shocking to me. Just inspiring. Moore is among several Cyclone tight ends vying to earn snaps this season after two of the program's best tight ends, Charlie Kohler and Chase Allen, have moved on to chase NFL dreams. He got to campus last summer, looking the part from a physical standpoint, and still does. But now Moore feels he's developed the mental tools to contribute both on special teams as well as in the passing and running games. Probably the first couple weeks of last year's fall camp, I was missing signals, and I was having a lot of MAs, which are missed assignments, said Moore, a former four-star recruit by 247 Sports who chose ISU over Arizona State and Central Florida, among other schools. So mentally, that took a toll on me to where I was like, maybe I'm not good enough to play here. At that point, I was just having talks with head coach Campbell and tight end coach Taylor Mauser and figuring out I am good enough to play here. I've just got to be confident in myself because when I'm confident in myself, I feel like I'm pretty good out there. He's not alone in that assessment. Iowa State football is so important to him, Mauser said. Being a tight end is so important to him. Just how far he's come mentally. I mean, physically, he's always been huge, but he wears his emotions on his sleeve. He reminds me a lot of Charlie in that sense, and he wants to make every play and make every block and be able to handle adversity and come back to make big plays. The maturity that that guy has over the last 2 years has blown me away. So he's swinging for the fences, so to speak. But what did he learn from his Little League World Series experience? Keep your composure at all times, the 6'5", 249-pounder said. Because I feel like there were some times where I failed to do that when I was that young and I just really learned from that, to grow from that, to just always keep your cool. And we'll finish today with one more Field of Dreams story, this from Zach Martin of the Globe Gazette. Cubs OF Reyes feeling at home in Iowa. Home sweet home? Even though Franmil Reyes has never stepped foot in Iowa until Thursday afternoon, he felt something familiar from his home of Sabana Grande de Palenque in the Dominican Republic. When the plane landed and I saw the corn, it feels like my home, Reyes said. Back in the Dominican, I live where the farms are. Everything is very green. This is great. It is like playing at home. The Chicago Cubs outfielder walked around with a smile on his face as he took in the sights and sounds at the Field of Dreams. Up until a couple weeks ago, he wasn't going to be in this game. He was in the Cleveland Guardians organization before getting designated for assignment. The Cubs picked him up. For me, this is a blessing, Reyes said. He called this a dream and mentioned how he's watched the Field of Dreams movie 2 times. Seeing everything in person from the ghost players to the stadium, he was in awe. And he'll make sure every inning and every pitch to soak it all in. This is amazing, and I'm very thankful for this, Reyes said. I'm going to enjoy every moment. This is an amazing experience. I get to share with my family and hopefully one day my kids play here. When the Cubs were facing the Cincinnati Reds in a regular season series, they made one of the media, rooms into a mock setup for the Field of Dreams game. Outfielder Ian Happ enjoyed getting his teammates prepared and did some Iowa traditions along the way. "Shucked some corn," said Happ, who will be mic'd up for the game with Reds first baseman Joey Votto. Much of the Cubs players waltzed to the movie site adjacent to the stadium and walked out of the corn. "Practice makes perfect." "It was fun," infielder Nico Horner said. The dimensions at the temporary stadium in Dyersville are 335 feet down the corners, 380 to the gaps, and 400 to straightaway center. There were a handful of home runs in last year's edition. Some of the favorites to belt one into the corn will be Votto, Reds third baseman Jonathan India, and for the Cubs, Happ and catcher Wilson Contreras. "Home runs only," Happ joked. India mentioned how he would want the ball back if he made his trek around the bases. "I would love the ball back. I'd trade anything for it," he said. Votto isn't one for keepsakes. "Just the memory is enough," he stated. Reds manager David Bell and Cubs skipper David Ross each were sentimental about riding into town, seeing the crowd and how welcoming the people were. They were enamored. "You start to realize what is so special about this day," Bell said. "My favorite part was people on the side of the road. There was a lot of people." "It exceeded expectations," Ross added. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette. My name is Rachel Thorson Mithelman, and I've been your reader today. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.